Moncrief
on News Talk
with Gas Networks Ireland. Natural gas is compatible with a wide range of modern appliances. gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.
Now, on July the 22nd, 2011, Anders Breivik arrived on a Norwegian island and set about killing the young people there who were attending a Norwegian Labour Party summer camp. 69 people died. One of the people who survived that horrific attack was Bjorn Iller. Bjorn Breivik shot at him, but the bullet missed. Bjorn, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
Tell us something about your circumstances at the time. You were in university in Liverpool, as I understand it.
Yeah, I was studying theatre and performance design and technology, of all things.
And so what brought you back to that island?
Basically, summer vacation. It was the middle of July, so not much school going on. And so I went back to Norway to work for the summer. And then while I was in my office, I got bored, as one does in offices. And my friend started texting me about the summer camp they were at. And I decided to go out and join them.
And so the first, before Breivik appeared, the first thing that you had been told, I mean, you, all the people on the island had been told, was about this explosion in Oslo.
Yeah, we were told about the explosion in Oslo, and we started checking out pictures on our phones and saw the images from downtown Oslo, which, didn't look like the hometown I grew up in, where certainly car bombs wasn't a part of the reality at the moment.
Mm. And how many people were killed by that bomb?
8 people died in the bomb.
Yeah, and so obviously then there must have been a lot of anxiety because people would have been worried about their families, etc., back in Oslo.
Yeah, so we were about 30-odd people from Oslo, and we shared the phones we had with batteries left in them to try to call our families and make sure that everyone was okay. Also, the organization we were with, the Labour Youth Party, had their headquarters in the area. And we had some people there, so we tried what we could to make sure that everyone was okay, and thankfully everyone we knew was.
Though I suppose, and the organisers couldn't have known at the time, it was decided that the safest thing to do was to remain on the island.
Yeah, no, that was the message we got from the leadership.
And so what was the time lag, if you like, between hearing about the bomb in Oslo and Breivik appearing on the island?
So that must have been like an hour and a half or so, maybe less.
You became first aware of it how? I assume it was you heard noises.
No, so I started hearing the gunshots, and I'm not terribly familiar with gunshots, so I thought maybe it was fireworks or something like that. And, then someone came running towards where we were. We were in the center of the island, and they told us to stay where we were, basically, and to get other people to come to the center of the island, from which you can't really see across the lake. And so we realized that maybe someone was standing on land shooting at the island, in which case we would have been safe. But then as people came to where we were, a man in dark clothes walked across this hill, and some people ran towards him, and he lifted a handgun and shot them straight down.
Because where a lot of the tents were, it's almost like it's a hollow. And therefore,
yeah.
he appeared on one of the edges of that hollow and just was able to shoot down at people.
Yeah, essentially.
And when the realization of that dawned, I suppose all anybody could do was just run for their lives. And were there areas where you thought there might be some sort of cover?
I mean, the island is very small. It takes about 10 minutes to walk around it. And it has some foresty bits, but they're not really great for hiding because the trees are far apart from each other and the terrain is fairly open. And so there's not really much cover as such. But, you know, we tried what we could, and we hid where we could find spaces. People were hiding in the kind of rocks and cliffs on the edges of the island, and people were really creative about finding hiding spots, I guess is one way of seeing it.
And yourself and a friend, and you found two little boys, an 8-year-old and a 9-year-old along the way. And you, generally speaking, tried to hide in a forested area, is that correct?
Yeah, so we tried to hide in the forest with one of the kids, and I was lying halfway on top of him, covering him and holding him so he wouldn't run away and scream, because that would reveal where we were. Mm. But after a while, I wasn't good enough a hiding spot either, because Breivik came walking straight through where we had been hiding. At that point, we'd run away along with a larger group of people who came running away from Breivik's shots.
And that little boy who you were trying to keep quiet, his dad was his dad was one of the security guards there.
Yes, he was. He was one of the security guards, and among the first people to get shot was later revealed to us during the trial and such.
But it seems as if you did reach a point where you literally ran out of ground and Breivik was upon you.
Yeah, I mean, we ended up on the rocks at the southern edge of the island, and from there we could see boats on the water and the longest line of blue flashing lights from police vehicles on land, and there was a helicopter in the air above us, and we ended up sitting there on the rocks thinking that finally this had come to an end. And then out of the woods behind us came this man in a police uniform, and he said that he was from the police and that they'd caught the bad guy. And as he was doing that, he lifted his gun and started shooting at our group, and we had nowhere else to run than straight into the water, and so I did. And I swam, sort of crawling on the ground and so forth, straight outwards, and I sort of sank because I was wearing a massive woolen jumper, and I think bullets flew over me as I was underwater, so it must have saved my life. And then I pulled the jumper off and stood back up in the water and looked back towards land where I saw Breivik take aim at me.
And that bullet missed by centimetres?
By centimetres, yeah.
Amazingly, though, he seemed to have, because one of the little boys was just remained frozen on land, and for whatever reason, he decided to spare his life.
The boy came out into the water and he was frozen in the water while Breivik sort of decided to spare him. I think Breivik explained later in court that that he spared the young ones because they didn't seem to have been indoctrinated by the Labour Party policies yet. And so he thought there was still hope for them, while for, you know, the rest of us in the range from 14 years and older, there was no more hope of not being brainwashed by the Labour ideology, or so it was in his mind, at least.
So afterwards, obviously, great psychological trauma for everyone who lived that through that experience, including yourself, and you did go back to college, but you made the decision to go back to attend his trial. Why did you make that? Why did you decide to do that?
So kind of in the immediate aftermath, I needed to understand what had happened and why it had happened. I needed to understand why did this man want to kill me, because that seemed pretty surreal to me. And Breivik on paper isn't terribly difficult, different from me. He grew up in the same city as me and under fairly similar circumstances when it comes to education and such. And so I wanted to figure out kind of how Breivik ended up being Breivik. And I guess that's kind of been a continuous exploration ever since, because it's difficult to come to any conclusions there.
Because I suppose it's easy to jump to a conclusion that it's just some form of mental illness, and that's the difference. Do you think it's more than that? It's a political difference.
It is definitely a political difference. And if you look at it, there's, you know, Breivik is not alone. He's not the only far-right extremist out there, and he's not the only one to think that the Labour Youth Party in Norway is the great evil of Norway. And, you know, there's several other people who agree with Breivik's politics. And on the far right, it's a fairly common thing to say that they agree with Breivik's policies, but not with his methodologies.
Mm. But is that the key difference, though? Because, you know, while people may have different points of view about around various issues, the difference with Breivik is he decided to pick up a gun and shoot 69 people.
Well, I mean, he did it to a larger extent than others usually do. But you see people pick up guns and you know, kill people every day. And so that's not really the big difference either, I think. And you also see that happening from the far-right extremists across the world. I mean, I've spoken to and know people who have been terribly close to Breivik's actions in some sort of way. I know people who've stockpiled weapons in the woods in Sweden in order to overthrow the Swedish government and so forth. And I think Breivik is kind of more similar to others than we sometimes like to acknowledge, because, you know, Breivik is scary, and acknowledging it is scary, and figuring out what to do with it is difficult. But that is a challenge I've kind of taken upon myself, and that's why I know all these people, by the way, because I've been meeting with more former violent extremists than most people have, and been going around and trying to explore how do they become violent extremists. And in that process, I realized that I was speaking to a lot of former extremists, people who used to be extremists. And so my question became, how did they stop being extremists?
Which and is yeah, well, that's
kind of my current exploration.
That's a very key question. How did they become being former extremists? How do you, if you like, bring someone back into having some sort of involvement with mainstream politics, with civil society again?
So it seems to have to do with basically realizing some key facts about humanity, like all humans have some value in themselves. And the fact that we are different and we can be different and we can live together as diverse people. And a lot of that has to do with knowledge and the fact that you know, as soon as you introduce a wider spectrum of knowledge to someone, they start seeing the world differently. And they start being less certain of themselves to, well, it requires a certain level of being certain of yourself to be willing to kill someone and do something so irreversible, if you like, because of your beliefs. And so if we can essentially dismantle that certainty in your own beliefs to some extent by diversifying your worldview and saying the world is, it contains more shades of color than the black and white you're willing to see, then that is a really key step. And that's kind of where my main focus lies right now.
And can that be difficult to do, Bjorn, especially nowadays when so much distrust has been sown in media outlets, in governments, where, you know, someone can, a potential Anders Breivik will not believe anything they see or hear or read?
I think the lack of trust is definitely a key issue, and it's something we need to address, and something I'm addressing through, among others, the Ananas Foundation in the UK. And we were looking at basically how to bring in information and create a relationship between the sources of information and the consumers of information, if you like. And so essentially showing the diversity of sources that confirm each other and contradict each other, and showing that information is more dynamic than just simple facts. Sometimes we have interpretations of things as well. And I think being open to disagreement is important, but also knowing that, you know, there is a core of truth in there somewhere. And so you can't just dismiss everything as false news and propaganda and lies.
Mm. By the same token, can people who, you know, live in social democratic societies to some degree exist in a bubble and not be exposed to other points of view? And should they be exposed to the other points of view, no matter how reprehensible they might find them?
Oh, I think to some extent we all live in bubbles, and we should do what we can to burst our own bubbles and try to look outside of them.
But say say in universities, you know, the idea of safe spaces and all that kind of stuff, do you think that's a good idea?
Yeah, I think, well, I think universities should be spaces for debate and spaces for, you know, having open discussions about the nature of reality and the nature of facts and the nature of our societies. And you can't really do that if you're not willing to hear and discuss and see certain points of view.
Even if those views are pretty reprehensible views.
Yeah. So, you know, people are having these opinions, and there's nothing much we can do about that unless we are open to discuss those opinions and views and disprove them where we can and challenge them as much as possible. And you can't really challenge something you're not willing to hear.
After the Breivik attack, Bjorn, how long did it take you to reach a point where you just felt safe again?
That took a really long time. I mean, we were basically kind of in our eyes, because Breivik was wearing a police uniform, attacked by the police and by someone who looked like, you know, what was supposed to be safety in our context. And so that was extremely difficult. And, you know, finding that sort of safety again has been a big challenge. And I think it did something with me and my view of safety at all. That makes it really difficult to find that again still. Although right now I feel, you know, better and more at peace than what I did. And it's still a question of what does safety really mean in a world where even when you're at summer vacation in the middle of the Norwegian countryside, something like that can happen.
Bjørn, thank you very much for speaking with us today. Bjørn Ilar is a technologist, activist, speaker, academic and artist working to promote peace and human rights.
Moncrief on News Talk.
With Gas Networks Ireland. Natural gas is compatible with a wide range of modern appliances. gasnetworks.ie/movetogas.